Case number 204159, Yerbrough Turner versus McCullough Hyde Memorial Hospital. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Newman, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Newman, and I represent the appellant Yerbrough Turner. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please. Mr. Turner is here today and has brought this appeal to address two issues with the district court's opinion. As to the first issue, which involves whether he can make out a prima facie case of discrimination, this case before the court today is very similar to one it decided in 2015, Wheat versus Fifth Third Bank. So Wheat resolved a tension between Klein v. Catholic Diocese of Toledo and Mitchell v. Toledo Hospital. And that tension is, how do you show that comparators are similarly situated with one another when the defendant says that they did not engage in similar conduct, but the plaintiff says, wait a minute, neither did I. I dispute that I engaged in that conduct. So in Wheat, the employer fired the plaintiff after he got into a fight with another employee, Hatfield, and Wheat argued that his termination was discriminatory because only he was fired and not Hatfield. The employer said, well, Wheat was the only aggressor here, and the district court took up that rationale. It found that there was no apples-to-apples comparison between Wheat and Hatfield because only one had been the aggressor, so Wheat could not establish a prima facie case. But this court reversed summary judgment, explaining that the identity of the aggressor was the key fact in dispute. So when viewed in a light most favorable to the plaintiff, as the court must do on a summary judgment motion, the evidence showed that the two were similarly situated. Now, turning to this case, the hospital's reason for firing Mr. Turner is that he had certain alleged performance deficiencies that warranted his termination on day 59 of a 90-day probation period, in spite of a 33 career at McCullough Hyde Hospital with no disciplinary record whatsoever. The district court found that Mr. Turner could not show that his coworkers were similarly situated because they didn't share the same alleged performance deficiencies. And to reach that conclusion, the district court construed numerous factual disputes undergirding defendant's rationale in favor of the hospital. But this court's precedent does not permit that, and neither does Rule 56. Critically, Mr. Turner is not the only witness in this case to dispute the defendant's rationale. Some of these disputes are internal among defendant's witnesses. Often their conclusions don't actually match their factual observations, which are more reliable. So, for example, the 90-day performance analysis opines that Mr. Turner couldn't accept feedback without getting defensive or couldn't follow instructions, but some of the examples cited just don't support that at all, and neither does the deposition testimony.
How would you respond? I saw there was several reasons listed in that 90-day letter. One of the reasons was a kind of walking away from the linens when the linens were being put away. Several people testified to that. I'm not certain that I saw that there was a dispute of fact on the point. It seems to me that everybody testified that this happened, and your client seems to admit, at least on occasion, that he suggests it's because it was a small room. But why isn't that enough to rebut any claim discrimination?
You're correct, Your Honor, that there is a consensus around that fact. It's the interpretation that becomes problematic. So in Mr. Turner's declaration, he says, when I saw that, you know, there was enough people here doing it, it was getting done, I went and took care of other tasks we needed to do for the day, which, you know, could be interpreted as actually taking initiative. I want to touch on the consensus that you mentioned. It really is not as helpful a fact for defendant. And the reason is Ms. Bowman, one of the central supply employees, said, okay, of the five of us, it was usually me and two other people putting away linen on any given day it was delivered. So that would leave two people out of, you know, people putting it away of the five. When it was Mr. Schmidt, who was one of the two people who wasn't there, Both Ms. Bowman and Ms. Saunders assumed, oh, well, he was doing receiving. That's, you know, another part of his job. Or Ms. Bowman said, well, he might be putting in reports or orders. But when Mr. Turner is not one of those five, the witnesses assume, yeah, he's avoiding work. He's blowing off work. That negative inference is only made with respect to Mr. Turner. A jury could find from that disparity in how the employees make assumptions about one another that the reason that there's that difference is because of his race. He's the only African-American employee of this group of five. So if I may turn back to the first issue of the prime, I guess it still is the first issue because it concerns disputed conduct
Oftentimes the issues kind of collapse, don't they? I know prima facie is supposed to be a lower burden, but you still have to, this is a pretext case because that just switches the burden to the defendant to show a neutral reason, and they clearly satisfied that burden. So I'm not even certain why we're talking about prima facie case. Why don't we just move directly to pretext, and it's your higher burden that you have to...
Sure, that's fine by me. And really, it's all the same because the disputes that we say make... Well, yeah, let's cut to the chase then.
Well, okay. What do you make of that, just kind of the general atmospheric point, that what sense would it make if they were going to fire based on race discrimination... They would have just never rehired Turner, and the employer rehired Turner immediately after the transition to TriHealth. If it was based on race discrimination, that would have been the time to let Mr. Turner go because there was an obvious reason lots of people were let go, including his former boss. But they gave him a chance. What sense would it make to fire him for race discrimination reasons, 60 days later?
Well, so... Ms. Schlottman, who fired Mr. Turner, it's not at all clear that there was no arm's-length hiring process. He was laid off, I think, for about 3 days. And then it was Brian Krause, who's above Ms. Schlottman in the organization, who says in that email, hey, can we find a spot for Yarb? Her response is far from sanguine. She says, possibly. I just wasn't seeing the initiative. She's not sure why that's the case, but... From the get-go, she's skeptical of Mr. Turner's work ethic, which, again, goes not only to, I guess, her honest belief defense. You know, did she honestly believe Turner had these problems, or was she biased against Turner from the start? So, you know, the facts don't support the conclusion that Ms. Schlottman, you know, at arm's length from a pool of applicants, hires Mr. Turner. It can be inferred from the evidence at the behest of her superior in the organization. There are also factual disputes under all three prongs of Manzer I'd like to touch on. The first being the prong that part of the reason or some of the reason has no basis in fact. I think the one that's most material is what I'll call the Christmas Eve incident. This was cited in Ms. Saunders' deposition as the time she counseled Mr. Turner about teamwork and really her one concrete example of him trying to shirk linen duties. Now, she describes this in her deposition, but also in the record was Mr. Turner's timesheet, and that was produced by the defendant. And that timesheet shows that Mr. Turner had pre-approved paid time off that day. So this just didn't happen. That dispute in the record has a number of effects. It certainly undermines Ms. Saunders' credibility as to this fact. It could undermine her credibility as a general matter because of this mistaken recollection. And it takes away... As I said, the most concrete reason she could provide, so then what that leaves is much more vague impressions. Vague impressions like, well, I don't think he wanted to be here. He acted like he didn't want to be here. More impressions about teamwork as well. He didn't seem the most motivated in a team. I think that's on the analysis. This court has said in Brewer v. New Era, these kinds of comments about teamwork or fitting in, these deserve extra scrutiny because these terms specifically, as well as any kind of subjective analysis, can be a screen for discrimination. The district court didn't scrutinize those subjective evaluations. It took them at face value to find that Mr. Turner was, you know, that he possessed all of these traits. Then we've got the second Manzer prong. That's that the proffered reason did not actually motivate termination. There are a bunch of examples here. I think the most material is the one cited in the 90-day analysis concerning a computer report. So Mr. Turner was having an issue with some kind of report. He asked another employee, Catherine Johnston, for help. And contemporaneously, Ms. Schlottman said, good. And Mr. Turner said, I did this because Ms. Saunders told me to. And she said, great, follow Ms. Saunders' instructions. That's in an email in the record. Yet 3 weeks later, it shows up on the 90-day performance analysis purporting to justify his termination. So if contemporaneously, it didn't justify any discipline, it was good, a jury could certainly reject that 3 weeks later. I see I'm out of time. With respect, we ask that the court reverse and remand for trial on the merits. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Evan Priestley on behalf of the Appalee McCullough Hyde Memorial Hospital. Your Honors, the district court correctly held that the appellant, Yarbrough Turner, could not establish a prima facie case of racial discrimination, nor could he show that the hospital's legitimate non-discriminatory reason for his discharge was actually a pretext for racial discrimination. District court's opinion should be affirmed. Your Honors, perhaps too often we get mired in particular details or arguments in a case without stepping back and remembering how those fit within the bigger picture of a particular claim. In other words, as the expression goes, we lose the forest for the trees. Mr. Turner's briefing and arguments to this court highlight the risk of how that could lead to an incorrect result. The reality here is that Mr. Turner lacks the very basic thing that he needs to prosecute a racial discrimination claim, which is any evidence upon which an inference of racial discrimination could be made. Mr. Turner was not replaced by a non-minority. He has no evidence that Amy Schlottman, the undisputed decision maker with regard to his discharge, had the same issues with Mr. Turner's coworker's performance that she saw with Mr. Turner's. And Mr. Turner has no evidence of any racially derogatory comments, any racial hostility from Ms. Schlottman or anyone else at the hospital. The district court's opinion should be affirmed for this simple reason alone. And Mr. Turner tries to avoid this by first arguing that the legitimate non-discriminatory reason for his discharge should not be considered within the prima facie analysis of his claim. And he uses the guise of that argument to avoid having to analyze the fact that there is no evidence that any of his coworkers had the same performance issues that were identified in the performance analysis authored by Ms. Schlottman. In other words, he avoids the fact that he has no evidence upon which even a rebuttable presumption, of race discrimination could be created.
But in most of these cases, of course, the plaintiff is going to have to rely on pretext or inferences from evidence because the defendant is not going to admit to having engaged in racial discrimination. So I guess we could go through those. What is your response? I thought there was no dispute of fact that Mr. Turner would occasionally walk away from the linens duties. And then the response is, well, other coworkers did the same thing and they weren't punished. Why isn't that unequal treatment? Why isn't the record support that, number one? And number two, would that be enough to raise an inference that it was because of race?
No, Your Honor. In fact, I mean, I believe as counsel conceded that it's undisputed in the record that Mr. Turner was observed by his coworkers and by his supervisor, Ms. Saunders, and by Ms. Schlottman, his manager, that he avoided the linen duties on occasion. But most importantly, Mr. Turner himself admits in his declaration that he filed with the court that he did the same.
I agree with that, but he tries to justify it by suggesting that so did the room was very small, and so not everybody was in the room at one time. So the times that he would depart from the linen duties would be times when there's other coworkers performing that task.
Right. I believe what he stated was that when there was two or more people that were in the room performing the duties, that he would just simply choose to do other responsibilities. But there's nothing in the record. I mean, that was an assumption that he made, that the room was too crowded, that he wasn't needed any longer. But
Was anybody supposed to be doing it all together at once, four or five people?
At the very least, but there is record evidence that Mr. Schmidt, the fourth member of that department, had other receiving duties that none of the other employees had. So on occasion, he wouldn't be there because he would be performing those receiving duties. But there's no evidence that Mr. Schmidt had, you know, presented himself to the linen room, saw that other people were doing it, and simply turned around and walked away. There's no evidence in the record to support that same thing that Mr. Turner admits that he did, and that it's also supported by the manager, the supervisor, and the coworkers, that Mr. Turner would also engage in that same thing. And that gets to the issue, that the primary issue that that Mr. Turner's counsel has raised, is this issue about the consideration of the first issue on appeal, that they raised, the consideration of the legitimate non-discriminatory reason in the prima facie analysis of the claim. The entire argument is premised on the idea that there are genuine issues of material fact with regard to the reasons for discharge in Ms. Schlottman's performance analysis document, but there simply aren't. Mr. Turner goes to painstaking efforts to try and create issues of fact with that document, but the various examples that Ms. Schlottman lists don't lack any basis in fact. And as I mentioned, that the primary issue identified is this linen issue, and that's the one that the district court found to be most important. And just to reset, I mean, Mr. Turner's exact quote in his declaration is that on some occasions when I arrived at the linen storage areas and saw two or more of my coworkers were already sorting and storing the linen supplies, I would handle other tasks that were also part of our day's duties.
Would you expect the employer to say, look, this is your job, you have to do this. If you don't do it, you're not going to work here?
Mr. Turner admits that he knew that the two primary duties that he had were supplies and linen. So there's no dispute that he knew that those were his two primary duties. And there's also no dispute that he knew the linen, as compared to a number of the other duties that they have in that position, that was the one thing that happened at the exact same time, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So there was no dispute about when you were supposed to be performing those linen duties. Mr. Turner admits that he was aware, and that
White's point is that why didn't they... When he was seen allegedly walking away, why didn't somebody counsel him that, you know, this party, you need to start doing this, rather than just terminating him and telling him after the fact?
Well, I believe Ms. Saunders' testimony and Ms. Schlottman's testimony about that point is that he was in a probationary period, so they expected somebody to be able to take that initiative and perform the work. You have to remind somebody during a probationary period. I mean, that's a trial period. That's what it's designed for. So to have to sit somebody down and say, you know, hey, remember, these two primary duties that you have, you need to actually do them or else you're going to be fired, it would be helpful. Sorry.
I understand what you're saying, and that's what she said. Well, you'd think you'd be on your best behavior. But the reality is that there's a probationary period and takes time often for people to get into the job. And it seems odd that no one would say, I mean, you're still talking about, you're two-thirds of the way in, you have a whole nother period to go, that you wouldn't say, this is really disappointing, you need to do this, or else you're not going to be working here. And then it's just odd that you would do a write-up and then fire the person.
Your Honor, in terms of HR practice, perhaps, you know, different people could view that as more optimal, that you could remind someone that one of the two primary duties they have, they need to actually continue doing it before you move to termination. But nothing within that framework and a failure to do that doesn't establish that there's any sort of race discrimination by not doing that. And that, again, I think is the primary issue here, is that once you carve through all of the arguments that Mr. Turner makes, you're still left with no evidence that Ms. Schlottman's decision was based upon Mr. Turner's race. And further confirming that is the application of the same actor inference in this case. Now, Mr. Turner tries to downplay the importance of that same actor inference here, claiming that Ms. Schlottman did not actually hire Mr. Turner. The job offer document itself, which is Exhibit 4 to Mr. Turner's deposition, says that it was made on behalf of the head of human resources, Sharon Hancock, and Ms. Schlottman. But even if that was a distinguishing characteristic, even if Ms. Schlottman was not the only person who made the job offer, Mr. Turner, when he contends in his reply brief that Ms. Schlottman didn't recommend the hiring of Mr. Turner into her department, is simply incorrect. The emails at Exhibit 2 to Ms. Schlottman's deposition show that Vice President of Finance Brian Krause reached out to Ms. Schlottman and asked her about whether or not it would be what she thought about hiring Mr. Turner on into the position. Now, counsel characterizes her response as sanguine, but she says that she hadn't seen initiative, but she immediately follows that up with, but perhaps that was because of his prior boss. So she excuses that away and still says, yeah, let's give Mr. Turner a chance. I'm paraphrasing, of course. But beyond that, in addition to that, Ms. Hancock, the head of human resources, testified that Ms. Schlottman, quote, approached me about would I have a conversation with Mr. Turner to see if he was interested in that position. So even the head of human resources said that it was Ms. Schlottman, the decision maker at issue here, who ultimately came to her and said, hey, can you approach Mr. Turner and see if he's interested in working in my department? That ultimately resulted in the job offer to Mr. Turner, which he accepted. And this issue is even more important in this case because it again shines a light on the biggest issue here, which is that Mr. Turner has no evidence upon which to raise any inference of race discrimination. Again, he goes to great lengths in his briefing to try and dissect the various reasons included in the performance analysis, and he tries to quibble with, you know, things that he thinks that McCullough High Memorial Hospital should have done better during his probationary period. But where's the evidence that Ms. Schlottman engaged in any conduct that would raise an inference of race discrimination in that decision? There simply is none. Again, there are no racial comments. There's no allegation that Ms. Schlottman was hostile toward him because of his race. No evidence that she engaged in disparate treatment toward Mr. Turner. There's no evidence that Ms. Schlottman hired a non-minority to replace Mr. Turner. In making Mr. Turner's race discrimination claim even more tenable is the fact, again, that 60 days prior to Ms. Schlottman terminating his employment, she was asked about whether he would be given a chance, and she responded in the affirmative. As the same actor inference goes, it makes no sense that Ms. Schlottman would have recommended him be given a chance in her department, only to turn around 2 months later and terminate his employment because he's African American. Mr. Turner's claim doesn't stand the test of reason, and I submit that no reasonable jury would find that it does.
Can I ask, just setting aside the facts, maybe a more legal question about the summary judgment standard? It seems when the employer comes forward with a kind of a tangible, objective reason, maybe the showing for pretext should be quite high. I had a case where the plaintiff turned the wrong valve at a chemical plant, and it could have blown up the whole plant, and he was fired for that. That seems quite objective to me. There's a tangible reason, but when the reason gets more subjective, employers have every right under Title VII to fire for any reason. So subjective reasons are ostensibly fine, but it becomes more difficult to determine whether that's the real reason versus pretext. And I wonder, number one, where in your view, kind of on the objective scale of like that blowing up the entire plant versus where does this case fit? Would you say this is more on the subjective side, and why or why not, and how should we analyze that in thinking about when summary judgment is appropriate and kind of the pretext showing that you have to prove to get a jury trial in these cases?
Yeah, Your Honor, in this case, I mean, the performance analysis document lists the reasons that Ms. Schlottman had for Mr. Turner's discharge.
Wouldn't you admit that some of them were subjective, like the kind of responses, like kind of like he thinks he knows everything? It can be taken as somewhat subjective in my mind, not really tangible, just kind of interpersonal skills, kind of.
That ultimate conclusion, that opinion that someone reaches, I would agree is subjective. But in the performance analysis document, in every single section, there is an objective example which relates to the perhaps more subjective opinion that she offers about the performance. I would argue, Your Honor, even in the example that you gave, I mean, someone turning a valve that ultimately results in the death of someone. I mean, oftentimes employers are still in a position where they are making some sort of subjective opinion based upon an objective fact. Another hypothetical that perhaps could fit to clarify this analysis is, you know, you have a cashier who steals $5 out of the cashier till. In the grand scheme of things, that means absolutely nothing to the grocery store or whatever retail establishment that's at issue. But it's the perhaps subjective opinion of the employer that you're dealing with an untrustworthy employee at the end of the day that results from that more objective evidence that's there. So I would submit that in the vast majority of situations, employers are making subjective conclusions based upon objective facts. There are cases, I would admit, that where employers offer nothing but subjective opinions for their reasons for termination. You know, they just don't like someone's attitude or something to that effect. But when you back that up with objective examples that support those subjective opinions, then I would submit that there's no greater basis for scrutiny based upon an employer's reasoning in that situation, which is what we have here, than there would be in any other case, including the case that Your Honor mentioned about the plant with the valve. Your Honors, I see that I only have about 50 seconds left, so if Your Honors have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But if not, I would ask that this court affirm the opinion of the district court granting summary judgment to McCullough High Memorial Hospital. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I guess I'd like to begin my response with Mr. Priestley's comment that there's no evidence of disparate treatment. The disparate treatment, it kind of goes back to what Judge White said. Mr. Turner, during this probationary period, was not given an opportunity to learn because no one said anything to him. That goes, again, to credibility. Is it credible that he was fired for putting away patient garments instead of linen when no one said anything to him at the time? If it didn't warrant an informal coaching or a write-up, certainly a juror could infer it didn't warrant termination.
But termination in the probationary context is a little different. He's still under examination from his employers, isn't he?
That's
partly they want to see who has initiative. You can't tell whether someone has initiative by telling someone, be sure to do this.
Right. So showing initiative would still be part of what any employer would expect to see, but...
And could decide not to hire in the lack thereof, couldn't they, in a probationary period?
Certainly, but the conclusion that Mr. Turner lacked initiative, it doesn't match the facts cited there. It really does come down to interpretation.
But all I'm saying is that if that's part of what you're examining, the fact that he wasn't told to do something doesn't really go to that.
I guess what it goes to is this is a new hospital system with TriHealth having become affiliated with McCullough Hyde. They're using new software, new techniques, new linen, et cetera. There would still be some training that would need to occur. Training that Mr. Turner did not receive, but really, more importantly, feedback. He says, and Ms. Saunders does not dispute, that he got good feedback from her. He had no reason to know he was doing anything wrong. When he did talk to Ms. Schlottman, this didn't come up at all. In fact, what did come up are more facts that don't support his termination. For example, a lunch he took. They met about that. He, under old policy, was permitted to tack paid time off onto a lunch break. He did that. He told Ms. Saunders and Ms. Bowman he was going out. He came back. Ms. Schlottman said, well, I'm not sure if this new policy permits that. I'm going to need to follow up with you. So on January 13, she's not sure if that violates policy, but on February 11, that merits termination. They don't match one another. This is pretext evidence from which a jury could infer discrimination. This is classic pretext. I'll go back.
Can I ask, just because I want you to have a chance to respond, just to hear sure. What I'm thinking. What do you make of the fact that I think it was Schlottman who had to call Mr. Turner a few times because she didn't know where he was, and there's no evidence that occurred with the other coworkers. So how would you respond to that?
So I mean, that could be viewed as evidence of disparate treatment, given that Ms. Schlottman had other means of contacting Mr. Turner. Ms. Saunders said, you know, when she had to track an employee down, Mr. Turner, as well as his colleagues, she'd just go track him down. She asked everyone to leave a note. So
it wasn't the point that she tried to track him down and couldn't, and so.
Well, or she just called him because she assumed he wasn't, you know, where he was supposed to be. I'm just about out of time. I want to address very briefly the same actor inference. Ms. Schlottman being on the offer letter is not inconsistent with her acting at the behest of Mr. Krause. That discretionary inference need not be applied here and should not be applied here. Once again, we ask that this case be tried on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you both.